So I read Psalm 40, the first few verses at the beginning of the service, and I want to read it again now, but I want to read, instead of in the Message this time, I want to read in the New International. And I'm going to read the first 8 verses, and we're going to spend some time on that this morning. I waited patiently for the Lord. He turned to me and heard my cry. He lifted me out of the slimy pit, out of the mud and mire. He set my feet on a rock and gave me a firm place to stand. He put a new song in my mouth, a hymn of praise to our God. Many will see and fear the Lord and put their trust in him. Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, who does not look to the proud, to those who turn aside to false gods. Many, Lord my God, are the wonders which you have done, the things you planned for us. None can compare with you. Were I to speak and tell of your deeds, there would be too many to declare. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but my ears you have opened. Burnt offerings and sin offerings you did not require. Then I said, here I am, I have come. It is written about me in the scroll. I desire to do your will, my God. Your law is within my heart. We'll come back to that. I just want to say that, and I don't want to give you the whole quote because it's not necessary, but Tony Campola, American Christian sociologist, said something that I think is really important, is that it's not our past that defines us, it's our future. And I think that as Christians, we have so bought into what's going on around us, and we are so myopic in the way that we see things, that essentially all the stuff that we drag behind us are the things that define us. Whereas what the scriptures say and what it says for us as Christians is the thing that defines us is what lies ahead of us. It's who we are in Jesus. And although we're not there yet, that's what we are becoming. And we are defined, our identity is not in our history, although that shapes us, it doesn't define us. What defines us is who we are becoming in Christ. I just thought I'd say that right at the beginning because I think it gives a context to what I want to say this morning. I waited patiently for the Lord, and he inclined to me and heard my cry. He leaned towards me and heard my cry. What's interesting is that the beginning of the psalm begins, it's ostensibly a psalm that David writes. And David, I think what I'm going to do in the new term in September is we'll look at the life of David because it's amazing. But what David does is he says, I waited and waited and waited for God. And if you look at the life of David, there were times when it just seemed, even after he was anointed, where it just seemed Samuel did this whole big thing of him anointing, and so he waited and waited and waited. And I think that what we do as Christians, we've become so used to an instant society that we pray once or we ask once. We haven't really got hold of what Jesus says when he says, ask and keep on asking and keep on asking and knock and keep on knocking and seek and keep on seeking. It's a present continuous tense in the Greek. The Greeks aren't with us this morning, so I can get wax lyrical about the Greeks. But the point is, I think we've got to the point so much in Western culture that I was saying to some people, where can I buy one of these? I haven't bought one of these in the UK. And they said, Pamela says, just Amazon, just let them send it to you. I mean, you know, it'll be here tomorrow. We have an instant society, and we want an instant God. And what David is saying to the people is that we wait patiently. And Eugene Peterson puts it really well, I waited and waited and waited. How long are you prepared to wait? How long are you prepared to wait? What happens if the thing that you ask you never see? How long are you prepared to wait? God listens and he hears. And it says here that he, then there are three things that he does. He leaned towards me and heard my cry. He brings me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the mud and mire. He sets my feet on a rock, four things, and he puts a new song in my mouth. It is God who does the stuff. And so we tend so often in the beginning of our thing to think, what must I do? What must I, how can I make things happen? And the interesting thing is, David waits and waits and waits and waits. God listens, hears, and then it's God who does these things. You are set free from your sin, not because of anything that you have done. You can walk with freedom, not because of anything that you've achieved. You can have life in all its fullness, not because you were a good boy or a good girl, but because of what he does for us through his son. And I think that is foundational in any understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. We wait for him. We don't run ahead of him. Anything we do that is outside of that is idolatry. And so we begin to see, and he puts a new song in our mouth. We basically sang that. He sets our feet on a rock. He makes us firm. He puts a new song of praise in our mouth. Many will see and hear and will trust in the Lord. And we've skipped over so many of these things. And I want to say, this passage is one of my favorite passages, this whole Psalm 40. And when I was in the army, we had these brown things that we used to wear that had two pockets up here. And most of the guys used to keep their fags in their pocket. My parents gave me a Bible this big, and it just fitted perfectly. The button just closed. And I used to do everything with my Bible in my pocket. And the first psalm when I was in the army that I started to memorize was Psalm 40. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He lifted me up. And so it goes on. And what I want to say about that is that so often we become accustomed to what we know and we don't move on. We need to wait for God. And I'll come back to this in a sense at the end when we get to verse 8. But what I want to sort of highlight this morning as well is this. When you have favorite passages of Scripture, you have them for a reason. And I would hazard a guess that most of them have some kind of emotional attachment, some kind of moment when you experienced God in that moment. And so they have a certain life that they have for you. The danger of that is that you live off past experience of God. And what this passage is saying is that we wait and we wait and we wait for God, not to regurgitate or reenact what we had years and years ago, but to experience in a fresh and vital way who God is and what he means for me in this moment. That he can lift you up out of the miry clay and set your feet on a rock and put a new song in your heart. Not historically, but today. We all face heartache. We all face difficulty. Nobody in this room is immune. We all face relational issues. We all face bodies that don't work properly in some way or another. We all live in a society that is pushing in the opposite direction of the one that we want to go. You're not on your own. But what you do need, and I think it's important to say it over and over and over again over the years, is that you need a vital relationship with Jesus. A vital relationship that is living and active and real today. Not yesterday, that's good. Or the day before, that's also good. But it's today. How do you experience Jesus today? What is it that you are experiencing today? And we wait and we wait and we wait until there is that reality for us. And God lifts us and puts a new song in our heart. How blessed is the man and woman who has made the Lord his trust. And I think that's the point. Who do you trust? That's where the blessing is. Do you trust yourself to be in control, or do you trust that God is actually in control of the entire universe? It's not easy, but it's the only way to live. So there are a whole lot of different things that I wanted to say about that, but I want to just get to verse 5. Verse 5 says, "Many, O Lord, my God, are the wonders which you have done, and your thoughts towards us. There is none to compare with you. If I were to declare and speak of them, they would be too numerous to count." How wonderful are your deeds, he says. Psalm 139 says, "How precious also are your thoughts to me, God. How vast the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand." Second Corinthians. I'm sure I marked it. Here it is. 9 verse 8. "God is able to make all grace abound to you, that you always having all sufficiency in everything, may have an abundance for every good deed." Point I'm making here is that when we live like this, when we live in the good of the moment, when we are experiencing the reality of God today for myself, we encounter the God who is able and who does more than we can even begin to ask or imagine, as Paul says to the Ephesians. A love that overwhelms us, a grace that is magnificent, that his thoughts towards us are like the sand on the seashore. And then it says, I'm hurrying on because I want to get to the last bit. "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required." So he repeats that in a double sense. So what he's reaffirming, he's saying, I do not need the ritual. Any of the ritual. It's interesting. I was reading N.T. Wright's commentary on Revelation week before last again. And he says, there is no temple in Revelation, in the new thing, because Jesus is our temple. All the Hebrews says all these things are now, we're a shadow of what has arrived, and it's arrived in him. Christ is the one who is the apex of all this stuff. He don't need to sacrifice anymore in that sense. We don't need the ritual. But what does he squeeze in the middle? Most of the translations say, "My ears you have opened." But they do that because it's a difficult word to translate without it sounding really clumsy in the original. Because it should be, "You have pierced my ear." And it takes us back to Deuteronomy. It takes us back to chapter 15, where in times of difficulty, Israelites would have offered themselves as slaves to other Israelites. And there was a law in chapter 15, I think it's verse 17 onwards, that you can go and read it. I'm not going to read the whole thing now. But basically what happened was, at the end of 6 years, in the seventh year, the person who had taken them as a slave was duty-bound to set them free. The freedom came often with a hang of a lot of insecurity, fear, and all kinds of other things, because they had become enslaved, they had offered themselves as slaves because of previous circumstance. Now, the injunction was to the owner to say to them, here is some animals, here is some grain. You know, in other words, here's something to help you on your way and to start you off on a good footing again. But for some of them, it was so frightening and difficult that there was an allowance made that if you wanted, you could offer yourself back to your master, who was one of you, but you could offer yourself back to him. But if you did so, it was a permanent arrangement. So if the master was kind and generous and it was a place where you were at home as a servant, then what they would do is they would take you and they would take an awl. And they would put you up against the doorpost, like this. And they would take the awl and they would pierce your ear. And it was a sign to everybody, if you had a pierced ear, that you had voluntarily decided to be a servant for the rest of your life. I know there's a church in Nairobi called Costco, and I don't know how big it is now, but I remember when I read this, they had about 8,000 people who were part of the church, massive church, meeting in different venues and so on. And one of the things that they do when you become a member of Costco is you actually physically sign saying, I will be a servant. Now, how do you think that would go down in the UK? Imagine. Someone might take the pen and stick it in your ear. But the point that is being made here by David, remember it's David, is that when we wait for God, when we experience the reality of his presence, when we understand how blessed it is for those who trust him, when we grasp the enormity of all the goodness and grace that he showers on us, all the thoughts that are towards us, we don't want some empty ritual. We don't want to just go through the motions. We say, here I am, Lord, send me, like Isaiah did. We offer our ear to be pierced. And in that sense, every person who follows Jesus, as he was pierced for you and I to serve us, which is literally what happened, that we might have life. So he's now saying to us, are you willing to be pierced? Are you willing to be a servant? Because the servant is not greater than the master. Are you willing to have your ear pierced? Are you willing to sign up to be a servant? Let me say it again. Are you willing to be a servant? And I was going to say that's not a rhetorical question. I'm not going to ask you to say it out loud if you don't want to. But the point is that that's the question that faces us if we have a relationship with Jesus. We are, because of the freedom to which we are set free, we have a choice. We can go off and do our own thing. Or we can say to the Master, I am your servant. And I think there are Christians who experience God, and it's all about them. It's what can they get out of it. It's literally a consumer Christianity. How can I be blessed? How can I experience the fullness of life? How can I be at the center of my little world with God looking after me? What he's looking for, I really believe, is people who will say, do you know what? I have been set free, but I voluntarily come and put myself up against the doorpost. And for the rest of my life, I'm willing to be a slave, a servant. And then I said, look, I come. In the scroll of the book, it is written about me. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. It's not an external thing. It's not something in your head. We were away for 10 days with our family, and I took stuff to read. I think I read about 30 pages in 10 days, which is like, for me, it's like a drought. But I was reading Thomas Merton and about contemplative prayer. And he's talking about the prayer of the heart. And he was saying, what is the distinction between what we know and most of what we understand in terms of our Christianity in the West is driven by how we think and what our thoughts are. But when it's in our heart, when the law of God, when this becomes not something that you read because it's a ritual or it's something that you have to do, or you get to know, you want knowledge about who Jesus is and what he did. When it becomes something in your heart that is inside of you, then the delight is to do God's will. Because the delight is to do God's will. Because his law is you've chewed on it. It's become intrinsic. It's become part of who you are. And I want to end off with one of my other favorite passages. This is David again. We might come to this again. But I want to read this to you because it talks about how David's relationship with God was vital and daily. I'm going to read it in the NIV because it's better. 2 Samuel, if you want to look at it, verse 17 onwards, it goes like this. When the Philistines got word that David had been made king over all Israel, they came on the hunt for him. David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. When the Philistines arrived, they deployed their forces in Rephaim Valley. Then David prayed to God, "Shall I go up and fight the Philistines? Will you help me beat them?" "Go up," God replied. "Count on me. I'll help you beat them." David then went straight down to Baal Perazim and smashed them to pieces. Afterward, David said, "God exploded on my enemies like a gush of water." That's why David named the place Baal Perazim, the master who explodes. The retreating Philistines dumped their idols, and David and his soldiers took them away. Later, there was a repeat performance. The Philistines came up again and deployed their troops in the Rephaim Valley. David again prayed to God. This time God said, "Don't attack them head on. Instead, circle around behind them and ambush them from the grove of sacred trees. When you hear the sound of shuffling in the trees, get ready to move out. It's a signal that God is going ahead of you to smash the Philistine camp." David did exactly what God told him. He routed the Philistines all the way from Gibeon to Giza. Now, how do you link Psalm 40 with 2 Samuel? And for me, it's a remarkable passage of the vitality of David's relationship with God. We've been talking over the last, well, we haven't, but everyone else ad nauseum has been talking about who's the next prime minister and what the cabinet's going to look like and what's happening. Is Iran doing what they're doing at the moment because we're vulnerable, and the transition and all this kind of thing? That's exactly the circumstance that David faced when he came. He was just anointed king, enthroned. And here the Philistines take opportunity to ram home their advantage, and they come up in the valley of Rephaim. David does not just go to his generals, to his military guys, and say, "We've got a problem on our hands. What do you think we can do? What's the best strategy? How are we going to deal with this? Are we at threat? Where are we going to get more men?" His first response is to go take a step back and say to God, "What do you want me to do? Can I go up against them? Will you give me victory?" And God says, "Go. It'll happen." So he goes out, and it happens exactly as God has said it will happen. David goes out with his army against the Philistines. They beat them up. And to such an extent that there's this word, Baal Perazim, which means essentially God breaks out like a great big flood, erupts into the middle of the Philistines. Job done. I heard God. Here's the trick, is that it says there, a little while later, in identical circumstance, the same people come to the same place and pose the same threat. I know what to do. You go out and you go straight and hit them head on and smash them again like we did last time. It's a piece of cake. We've done it once, we can do it twice. He takes a step back again. Don't forget, he's been victorious. He's a new king. He's asserted himself. He takes a step back and he says, God, what must I do? And God says to him, do not take them on head on. Go around the back of the sacred trees. And when you hear the sound of shuffling, the old translation puts marching in the top of the trees, then do that, and I will sort them out. And you think, oh, wow, that's amazing. But think of it. You've got all the military guys on the one side who are saying, come on, what's this praying? But we need to get out and beat these guys up again. And David comes from a time of prayer, from experiencing again the presence of God. And he comes to his generals and he says to them, guys, this is the plan. We're going to sneak around the back. Okay, ambush is good. And we are going to wait. Timing is everything. But we are waiting for the sound of shuffling or marching in the top of the trees. Yeah, right. Can you imagine trying to sell that to your generals? Can you imagine what David has to do to make that sense of reality for his guys? But he has a relationship with God that is real and vital, and it is known, and he takes it. And they beat up the Philistines again from Gibeon to Giza. And if you're going to look on the map, it's a pretty long way. Then I said, look, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is in my heart. It's part of me. I want to do what you want, God. I want to only do what you want, because who you are, all that you are, everything that you have said has become intuitive, is part of who I am. And I want to encourage you over the summer to read the scriptures, not to get more knowledge, not to find out what's going on, not to get through your reading, but to encounter the risen Jesus. To ask him to show you, to lead you, to direct you so that you can do his will. And wait patiently.